Good morning. My name is Joe. My pronouns are he and him. Hello to all of you on Zoom. Sometimes I can see myself among the people of the ancient Bible stories. They're just out there doing the human thing, working, learning, trying to get by in the world. Sometimes I can relate. But sometimes they go and whisper their sins into the ear of a goat and send it off as an offering to a demon in the desert. Slightly less relatable. As we heard from the book of Leviticus, in the ancient temple tradition, on the holiest day of the year, the high priest would bring two goats to the door of the temple. And there they would do their version of rolling the dice to choose between the two goats. One goat would be killed immediately on the altar to Yahweh as a purification sacrifice. The other goat, the lucky one, I guess, would be brought up before the altar, but not killed. Instead, the high priest would put their hands on the goat and offer a confession, naming all of the sins of Israel in the past year. Presumably, that was just the big national scandals. It would take a really long time to give a comprehensive list of the sins of everyone. After the sins had been uploaded onto the goat, then an attendant would take the goat out into the wilderness and set it free, carrying the guilt of the nation with it. The history is a little unclear as to what would happen from there. Some stories suggest that people would chase the goat, hunt it, and kill it. Some felt like sending it into the wilderness was a punishment in itself. The goat's going to be killed quickly, and the sins would die in that way. Some scholars think the goat was taken out into the desert to be sacrificed to Azazel, the demon god of undoing. And I like to think the goat really was set free and just carried on with its little goat life in the wilderness, none the wiser for all the sins he carried, just happy to have made his escape. That is where we get the word scapegoat, the goat who escapes. Apparently that is a mistranslation of that Hebrew word Azazel, which was more likely the name of that demon desert god Azazel, the remover and the undoer. Complicating that is things is that in Hebrew, the word for goat is the same as the word for demon. Perhaps our goat farmers can confirm the truth of that connection. It's further confusing the situation that the original scapegoat was the goat that escaped, and now our scapegoats are the ones that we don't let escape, the ones that we sacrifice at the figurative altar. So all of this is quite confusing. It's not exactly clear how the ritual was meant to function. And we're not sure what happened to the sins that were figuratively placed on the head of the goat. But somehow that one innocent goat carried the spiritual weight of the nation, took the blame of their sins, carried it away to somewhere else. Weird religion, hey? That reminds me, we are celebrating communion next week. I will provide the body and the blood. Bring your own guilt and shame. No goats, though. Where does this scapegoat idea come from? French philosopher René Girard said that the scapegoat was a pattern that showed up across all ancient human societies. The answer may be familiar to anyone who has been in a kindergarten playground, corporate boardroom, or a modern democracy. The members of the community gang up together against one unlucky victim and blame him or her for the crisis. This is all your fault. They chase him away, they beat him with clubs, they hang him from a tree, they vote him out of the council. One way or another, the scapegoat takes the blame and takes a violent punishment. And incredibly, all the other members of the group who were at each other's throats now see each other as allies in the fight against the guilty victim. Instead of me against you, it's us against the enemy. And so the community reconciles and joins together again as one. Of course, this crisis wasn't really the scapegoat's fault, but the members of the community believe that it was. They have to believe that it was, because their newfound peace is based on having gotten rid of that troublesome intruder. But over time, these primal Homo sapiens started to notice that this is a handy way to fix a crisis. Got a problem? Find out whose fault it is and shove them off a cliff. Even better, Girard says that ancient communities eventually ritualized their scapegoating. Why wait until things got really bad? better to sacrifice someone regularly just to be on the safe side. Last week, I asked the question, how do we live in a world of infinite complexity? The scapegoat mechanism is a big part of our collective answer to that. When I bump up against something too big or too awful for me to deal with, well, I just find someone to blame, real or imagined, shove them off a cliff. Sometimes this is easy because the scapegoat is obviously guilty. There's no defending these guys. They're hardly equal to each other, but they're all despised. And they all create unity by the mere mention of their name. We don't worship them, but we give them a ton of power because of what they've done. People like this represent the worst that we can imagine. We instantly recoil at any association with them. We line up against them. And so in a weird inversion, these villains bring peace by unified opposition. Never again. Very effective scapegoats, because the vast majority of us are convinced of their guilt. But nobody ever said that scapegoats had to be guilty.
It all began with an error on a research report, a misinterpretation that would condemn a Canadian, Gaetan Dugas, to be forever remembered as patient zero in the North American AIDS epidemic of the early 1980s, putting Dugas at the center of a hysteria that gripped the popular consciousness and consumed newspapers, radio, and television airwaves. Dugas, the subject of the new documentary, Killing Patient Zero, was an airline steward in the 1970s who, by 1980, as AIDS was beginning to surface, was receiving medical attention in New York, diagnosed with Kaposi's sarcoma, a previously rare skin cancer that would become a physical marker of the disease. It was there that the U.S. Center for Disease Control discovered Dugas, who quickly and eagerly helped researchers identify his sexual partners as well as provide his medical data.
He was, in a way, a hero of the epidemic because he's someone who helped researchers figure out what was going on. But subsequently, after his death, that same information was used against him to suggest that he was the man who brought AIDS to North America, which was an outlandish claim then, and it is now as well.
Yet that was the sensational claim made in 1987 by San Francisco journalist Randy Schiltz in his bestseller about the AIDS epidemic, and the band played on. Schiltz promoting the patient zero story, playing up the fact that Dugas' file was marked with what looked like a zero, as in the CDC's first reported case. That was wrong, though. It was in fact an O, indicating, quote, out of California, a detail that was almost trivial at the time, but would be seized on by Schiltz and then a media machine and public desperate to find a face, a person, a scapegoat to hold responsible for the alarming new disease.
Gaetan Dugas was not in any way patient zero. A 2016 genetic study proved that Dugas could not have been the first person in North America with AIDS. The strain of HIV that Dugas had was already present in the U.S. long before he contracted it. Neither did Dugas spread HIV across North America, as he was accused. The West Coast had a different strain of the virus from the one that Dugas had contracted in the East. The two strains could not have come from a single person. Of course, Dugas was not the only scapegoat of the AIDS epidemic. Before it was called AIDS or HIV, it was called the 4-H disease, as the syndrome seemed to affect heroin users, homosexuals, hemophiliacs, and Haitians. Or they called it GRID, G-R-I-D, gay-related immune deficiency. But AIDS was never exclusive to the gay community, or heroin users, hemophiliacs, or Haitians. But that didn't stop the generalizations. Emphasizing those groups for people who were not part of those groups, blaming and shaming those others, whether that was with outright hatred and fear or just the sympathy and feeling sorry for them, well, that made it their problem, not ours. They're putting themselves at risk. We're safe because we behave ourselves. They're being punished. We are righteous. They are dying. We have more important things to worry about. Again, from last week, our brains prefer a simple falsehood to the complex truth. HIV and AIDS was, still is, a complex truth. Everyone was scared. Nobody knew how to fix it. So it was a lot easier to believe the falsehood than to embrace the truth. Of course, we are so much more sophisticated than those generations in the past. We know that our pandemic, well, that's China's fault, or America's, or Trudeau's, or the unvaccinated's, or the media's, or the devil's, or God's. Somebody else is to blame. We are the innocent victims here. Whether you go all the way down the conspiracy theory rabbit holes or not, when you're scared, or tired, or angry, or inconvenienced, it feels awfully good to have someone to blame. Of course, the most tricky scapegoats are those who are somewhere in between guilty and
innocent. The semi-driver responsible for the Humboldt Broncos bus crash is fighting deportation to India. He's in the process of making his case to the Canada Border Services Agency on why he feels he should stay in the country. CTV's Laura Woodward explains.
Last year, Jaskarat Singh Sidhu, the truck driver responsible for the Humboldt Broncos bus crash, was handed an 8-year prison sentence. Now he could be forced to leave the country.
I think if people get to know more about Mr. Sidhu, they'll realize he's not a danger to Canadian society. He made one momentary mistake that any one of us could have made.
The crash that killed 16 people and injured 13 others happened about 5 years after Sidhu moved to Canada from India. Under federal law, permanent residents can be deported if they commit a serious crime. Sidhu is in the process of trying to convince the Canada Border Services Agency why he should stay in the country.
We're asking the immigration officers and the public to have open minds to consider the other side, to consider who this person is and do we really need to deport him.
Immigration lawyer Chris Veeman, who's not involved in the case, says it's likely Sidhu will get deported.
It would be pretty hard, I think, for them to not move ahead in this particular case. It's pretty black and white.
Veeman says Sidhu's case is unique because of the amount of people impacted. Veeman referencing similar offenses such as the Saskatchewan Premier's crash in 1997 when he failed to stop at an intersection, killed a 39-year-old mother and was given a ticket.
You feel like Mr. Sidhu is being he's being focused on because of the magnitude of the consequences as opposed to how bad his actions were.
If Sidhu does get deported, it would be after serving his prison sentence. Laura Woodward, CTV News, Saskatoon.
I'm really stepping in all the things today, hey? What do we do with that? He's guilty, but he's remorseful. He was definitely at fault, but it was an accident. His failure was at the center of the tragedy. Lots of other people and processes failed too. He caused a lot of harm, but he's done as much as he can since then to minimize harm. We want justice, and part of us wants vengeance as well. How do we balance all of that? Fortunately, for most of us, we don't have to. For better or worse, we have a legal system in place that is designed to efficiently assess where the blame is to be placed and what the punishment should be. Is that justice? Is that better than whispering our sins to a goat? There's that overwhelming complexity again. Doing justice for the Humboldt Broncos bus crash would take so much work. There's so many people and systems involved, each with their own story and situation, each impacted differently by what happened, each with their own needs to move forward towards healing. And even if we do all of that work, even if we get it all right, we still might not feel good about the conclusions. It's far simpler to attach our energy and our expectations to the fate of one man. Scapegoating is quite effective in a world of overwhelming complexity. Even when we recognize that it's unfair and unjust, I doubt that we will be getting rid of it anytime soon. Once again, I don't have any great answers for the problems of the world. I suspect that I'm not the only one who does a little bit of amateur scapegoating in my personal life, though. So let me close with three humble suggestions for making the best of our scapegoating tendencies. Number one, pay attention to the pattern. Recognize scapegoating when you're doing it. When you're feeling a particularly strong emotional reaction directed towards a group or a person, especially when you're rallying the troops and gathering others onto your side to create that us versus them dynamic. Ask yourself, is the intensity proportional to the perceived offense? What else is going on inside of me, in the air around me? Is there a more accurate, more helpful way to target these feelings and resolve the tension? Scapegoating, while efficient, isn't always the easier route either. It might be the quickest path to unity and stability, but it's only ever temporary, and it only works if the vast majority of us can be convinced that the scapegoat is truly guilty. The hard work of vulnerable conflict resolution might be a lot more efficient in the end. Number two, listen to the scapegoats. What is it about this person? Why am I putting this particular group onto the altar? Those who are being blamed for society's ills, the innocent scapegoats for sure, but also the guilty ones, are usually targeted because they are close to a significant place of non-resolution, a bigger problem in all of us, in our society, that we don't know how to solve. I don't support the values and goals of the so-called Freedom Convoy. And I can see that their movement was, perhaps still is, compelling because it sits at a huge pressure point for our country. Personal rights and well-being are almost always in tension with collective rights and well-being. We hold those in tension, and not always particularly well. We haven't figured that one out yet. Canceling a scapegoat on one side or the other won't resolve it. Whether the scapegoat in this case is guilty or innocent, the issue affects a lot more than them, and we should pay attention. Within Christianity, the community of sexual diversity is a huge scapegoat for all kinds of issues. Why is that? What is it about our history and tradition and worldview that has brought sexuality and gender to be such a point of conflict? Why do these ideas bring up such strong reaction these days, instead of other ideas that used to be flashpoints of controversy, like baptism or speaking in tongues? The scapegoats aren't the source of the tension. The tension existed already. And if we listen to the scapegoats, they have much to teach from their experience of living into that tension, being forced to carry it on behalf of the group. If you're interested in listening, I'll point you to two resources from queer leaders who understand Christianity extremely well. One is queertheology.com from Brian Murphy and Father Shannon Kearns. They have a lot of resources on their website and a weekly podcast that has interviews with other queer Christians. They do lots of Bible studies and more. Father Shannon tells his personal story in an episode called Transitioning My Body and Faith. And that's a good place to start. Another writer and podcaster talking about queer spirituality from a Christian background is Kevin Garcia. They have a book called Bad Theology Kills: Undoing Toxic Beliefs and Reclaiming Your Spiritual Authority. They also have a conversational style podcast called A Tiny Revolution with a wide range of artists and writers and pastors. You're not going to like everything that you hear from these guys. I can promise you that. But their work is thoughtful and vulnerable. It's a window into encounters with God that are quite different from most of ours. And if we listen, if we wonder how and why their faith brought them to where they are, there is so much to learn whether we agree with them or not. Number three, if we recognize what's going on underneath our scapegoating impulses, and if we listen to what the scapegoats are pointing to, I think we'll find that the complexity and the tension isn't just out there with them, but also in here with us. That's what Jesus was up to in the Sermon on the Mount. Why do you look at the splinter in your neighbor's eye and never see the board in your own eye? How can you say to your neighbor, "Let me remove the splinter in your eye," when the whole time there's a 2x4 in your own? Hypocrite, remove the board from your own eye first, and then you'll be able to see clearly to remove the splinter from your neighbor's eye. That's not just a generic, "Hey, nobody's perfect," observation. The point is that the splinter and the board are both made of the same stuff. This tension that I'm blaming on the scapegoat, that is part of me too. You want justice for murderers? Of course. Just don't forget that you also dehumanize the people around you with your thoughts and your words and your actions, come to think about it. You want justice for adulterers? Well, the lust, the needs, the weaknesses that drive them to their sin, those are also present in your heart. You want people to be accountable for breaking contracts? Well, you also break promises, bend the truth from time to time, to just a bit to fit your situation. You want to punish people who make mistakes with tragically unintended consequences? Well, let's take a closer look at some of the accidents that you've been a part of on the highway or elsewhere. You're angry with people who spread contagious disease. God forbid we ever see a virus that we can spread without even knowing that we have it. You're worried that trans women are making people vulnerable in public bathrooms. Guess what? Everybody is already vulnerable in public bathrooms. It's not because of the trans people. You blame cancel culture for threatening free speech. So you think the solution is what? Making cancel culture sit down and shut up? A few of those are less direct quotes from Jesus than others. The group that I rant about or worry about or wish would just go away, chances are I'm connected to the very thing that has me so worked up about them. Jesus continually calls us to personal responsibility for myself and compassion instead of judgment for everyone else. Because all of our junk, all of our sin is part of the same pile. The stuff that I can do something about, that's the stuff right here with me. Jesus' end game, though, is not about ending hypocrisy. That's just part of the human condition, this overwhelming complexity. The end game is accepting our hypocrisy and living more graciously with others and with ourselves. Father Richard Rohr says that's what the entire Christ experience is all about, the path to skipping out on the blame game entirely. On the cross, by becoming the undeniably innocent scapegoat himself, Jesus exposed the futility of the scapegoat mechanism and offered a glimpse at a better way. Let's listen to Richard Rohr as he explains what he sees in research into modern culture of blaming and shaming.
What enters in is a lot of victimhood and a lot of aggressiveness toward supposed perpetrators. In fact, what we've found at this point is the major paradigm of explanation is perpetrator-victim. This is what's made me wounded or suffer. My father did this to me. My mother did this to me. That I'm not pretty did this to me. It's so easy to look for someone to be the cause of my unhappiness, so I can rearrange other people instead of rearranging myself. Jesus doesn't allow that, because what he did, and you know what I'm going to say, he became the victim and did it as the jokester, finding freedom on the cross. I'm not going to play the victim. I'm not going to over-identify with you hurt me. Yes, you did hurt me, but I'm not going to be trapped there. I'm not going to be trapped there. I don't need to find someone to blame. I don't need to feel sorry for myself. It's a dead end. But boy, is that hard to learn. The person who blames others for his or her problems hasn't even begun their education. The person who blames himself has begun his education. The person who blames no one has finished his education.
He's not saying that we shouldn't seek justice for those who have been hurt, for those who are being hurt. Some of us have been deeply wounded by others. We should work for justice for those who have been abused. And we are not defined by our wounds. We are more than the hurt that has been done to us. Some of us are guilty. Some of us have done significant harm to ourselves and others. We should repent and seek restoration. And we are not defined by our failures. We are more than the harm we have done. We are all more than victim and victimizers, more than oppressed and oppressors. We don't need to be trapped in a cycle of scapegoating, whether it's being done to us or whether we're the ones doing it. That is grace, to accept the world around us and within us as it is. No blame required. So I pray that Christ may dwell in your hearts through faith, so that you will be rooted and grounded in love, able to grasp how wide and long and high and deep the love of Christ really is, the fullness of God. Amen.